This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us on this Friday, December the 5th. And this is The Week in Review. Every Friday at this time, we welcome in two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the significant political news stories of the week. And we have two guests with us today, as usual. Bill Leaders is with us, news editor at Isthmus Newsweekly in Madison. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
And also joining us by phone, Chris Lotto, public relations account executive at Avacom Marketing Communications, former communications director for the Wisconsin Republican Party. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. And if you would like to join us with an item from the news this week, we welcome you to call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, gentlemen, we just spent the last hour talking about the big three CEOs going before Congress yesterday, asking for $34 billion in bailout money in loans. Seems Congress was a bit skeptical. They're going to try again today. Bill Leaders, what do you think of should the federal government bail out the auto industry?
Yeah, but not on the auto industry's terms necessarily. A lot of people have noticed the huge contrast between the attitude of Congress toward the automakers' bailout and that toward the banks and Wall Street when they needed money. It was like, well, how much you need? $700 billion? Oh, sure, fine. No strings attached, no questions asked. But the automakers come and suddenly Congress has got real concerns about whether we should be giving any money to them. And I think one of the key differences is that the auto industry actually does something. It actually employs people. And Congress is more reticent to give money to that cause than it is to give it to bankers who have acted irresponsibly and gotten the nation into an economic crisis.
You think there's some class warfare going
on? Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things the automakers have been asked to do and have been doing is to come back to Congress with a plan on how they're going to cut jobs, how they're going to break their unions, how they're going to squeeze a little bit more work out of their workers, how they're going to roll back some of the advantages that the UAW has earned for its workers through the decades. And Congress wants that as a precondition before it parts with any money. It wants to make sure the working people get a little more of a raw deal out of the bargain. And I think the automakers are only too happy to oblige. What I think Congress should be doing more than that, and certainly as a primary thing, is to insist that Detroit change its attitude toward its business model, that it is set out to create fuel-efficient cars for the future, that it fundamentally change its approach to automaking and create an automobile for the future. Mm-hmm. And Congress ought to demand that before it gives Detroit one red cent.
So do you see it that way, Chris Lotto?
Well, I mean, I think it's obvious to everyone that to let the big three go under would be disastrous to an economy that needs all the help it can get at this point. I mean, not just the auto industry, but, you know, the ripple effects that are felt by, you know, other businesses that support automakers, by communities like Janesville that really rely on production to really survive and thrive. Something has to be done. But I agree with Bill to the extent that it cannot be a bailout. It needs to be a loan that is very carefully structured and that the government should do everything in its power to get paid back, similar to what was done with Chrysler in the late 1970s, where they received a loan but eventually did pay that back. The devil is in the details, but a lot of work has to be done. You know, the idea that labor is the key factor of concern here, I think, is perhaps a bit misleading. I saw a quote from one of the big three automakers that said, you know, the cost of labor is really only 10% of the average cost of a vehicle. So obviously what needs to happen is sweeping changes in the industry that really, and I never thought I'd say this, but has to be closely monitored by government. And government has to be sure that if they're going to put money into these automakers, that they're prepared to do whatever it takes to get that money paid back to the taxpayers.
Yeah, but my concern is that Congress and government is likely to insist that the automakers become more efficient by putting the screws to their workforce. And my preference would be that they insist that Detroit be more efficient in the type of automobiles that it makes, that it changes its attitude toward the market.
Well, I agree to an extent. I mean, I think that the big three understand that they have been, you know, not running the railroad very well. They need to be focused on a different model of car, a different way of doing business. And I think that, you know, union labor, we heard from the incoming Assembly Speaker Mike Sheridan, who was in Washington yesterday, and who seems to realize that some concessions need to be made. Everybody needs to give a little here, and I think the question is going to be in the coming days and weeks how much everybody has to give to make this work.
You know, I was driving into the studio this morning. I was listening to the guest in the hour before talking, expressing his pessimism about the long-term viability mm-hmm. of the auto industry. As I got about 2.5 miles from where I am now, the traffic started to thicken. When I got about 2 miles, it was bumper to bumper, and it stayed that way all the way to where I parked. And something occurred to me that, you know, maybe the long-term viability of the auto industry is not really in jeopardy, because there are nothing but cars and cars and cars on the road, and we're going to continue to need those cars.
Yeah, he did have doubts about the long-term viability, Bill, but the automakers are saying we're going to make these fuel-efficient cars. We're going to make these hybrids and electric cars. We are going to change the way we've been doing business. You're not convinced.
I'm not convinced. They didn't bring their corporate jets to Washington this time. They came with a few examples of fuel-efficient cars for the future that they wanted to show off. But having a few vehicles to show and tell is different from making a serious commitment to fuel efficiency. I think one of the villains in this, as in so many things, is George Bush. Several years ago, it was proposed that the nation insist on fuel efficiency standards for automobiles. He single-handedly stood in the way of that happening. If Detroit had positioned itself better for the future by embracing fuel efficiency back then, it would not be in the bind it is today.
Is it George Bush's fault?
I don't know what Bill and the others are going to do when George Bush is gone in a month and who they're going to blame. I guess they'll take a few more years to do that. I think it's rather naive to say it's all George Bush's fault. I think that clearly the big three automakers, in terms of management and looking to the future, have dropped the ball. And they were enabled by, politicians on both sides of the aisle. In Wisconsin, we wrote multimillion-dollar checks to keep keep GM afloat. Are we ever going to see that money? I don't know if we're going to. But clearly, part of the problem is that the big three automakers just kept on doing business like there wasn't going to be a problem with gas prices, like there wasn't going to be an energy crisis or concerns about the environmental impacts on the types of cars we drive right now. They have not been thinking ahead. And can they turn the ship around very quickly? Probably not. And that should be a cause for concern. Mm-hmm.
You know, Chris, I agree with you. I think there's plenty of blame to spread around. And I wasn't saying that George Bush is solely responsible, only that his resistance to fuel efficiency is one of the reasons that we're in the bind we are now. Looking to the future, though, I think we just have to make that commitment to a different kind of automobile and a different kind of future.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would absolutely agree with you. I certainly agree with you on that. I think that's one of the things that, again, if government is going to move forward in bailing out the big three, they need to be saying to them, what are you going to do? When are you going to do it? Give us a timeline and give us something that's realistic, and we're going to hold you accountable.
Let me jump in and mm-hmm. let's take a listen to President Bush. He's giving exit interviews to various members of the media this week. And Charlie Gibson talked to him this week about whether he takes any blame for the state of the economy.
Do you feel in any way responsible for what's happening?
I've been the president during this period of time, but I think when the history of this period is written, people will realize a lot of the decisions that were made on Wall Street took place over, a decade or so before I arrived in president, during I arrived in president. I'm sorry it's happening, of course. Obviously, I don't like the idea of people losing jobs or being worried about their 401ks. On the other hand, the American people got to know that we will safeguard the system.
So, President Bush is sorry, Bill Leaders.
Well, he's kind of passing the buck, too. It's not entirely George Bush's fault that the economy took a nosedive, but certainly it did happen on his watch, and he bears some responsibility, if not primary responsibility, for what has happened. And I think he's just trying to shuck that responsibility in statements that he's making now.
Mm-hmm. Chris Lotto?
Well, I agree. I don't think anybody really is blameless in this, and I think George Bush is included, and I think it's only fair for him to come under criticism because, he's the captain of the ship when this is happening. So I think it's only fair that he comes in for his share of it. But he's also right that these things do not happen in a day. The kinds of policies that get built up over time that become difficult to change until there's a crisis and everybody says, well, why didn't we change this a long time ago? Well, it's George Bush's fault. These kinds of things don't happen in a vacuum. And there are policies that have been in place that have led to the current financial crisis that had been around before George Bush was in office. Did he make an effort to try and change some of those things? I believe he did. Did he make a strong enough effort? Well, I think that's more of an arguable point.
Let's take a caller on this. Dave in Wanakee joins us. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. When I listen to George Bush, it makes him sound like a spectator in his own administration. He also doesn't take blame for the war in Iraq because he got bad intelligence. He doesn't say that he stovepiped the intelligence to prevent anything that would prevent the war from going on. He could have waited 3 months for the inspectors, but he chose not to. So I get really offended by George Bush saying that, you know, it was the others' fault.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree entirely, particularly on the Iraq question, where George Bush is now trying to blame the intelligence agencies for coming to the wrong conclusions about weapons of mass destruction, when in fact the intelligence that the Bush administration was getting was actually pretty good, and it would have led them to the conclusion that there was no need to go to war against Iraq if only they weren't determined to come to some other conclusion because of their ideological biases.
Chris Latta?
Well, I mean, the war in Iraq is something that was supported by members of Congress in both parties at the time. It has since turned out that the intelligence was faulty, and now we're here, and now what do we do to bring peace to that region and then get out as quickly as possible? You know, the endless sort of rehashing of how we got there. You know, everybody forgets that it wasn't just George Bush out there. It was a willing Congress that supported him as well at the time, and only in retrospect did they say, well, gee, maybe we made a mistake here. It's all George Bush's fault.
But it's important
to know. I think what has to happen going forward is we have to, you know, obviously the surge has worked. There's peace in that region, but now we're seeing terrorism kind of getting squeezed out of that area and moving to places like India, where it's becoming a whole different ballgame. Obviously, we want to get out of Iraq as soon as possible, but we want to do it in a way that's going to leave the nation better than we found it. And that's what needs to be the focus going forward.
We should talk about India and Pakistan, but I think it's important to note that the intelligence was faulty in Iraq because the Bush administration put pressure on the intelligence agencies to corrupt the reports that they were making and to have them come up with conclusions that weren't true.
We are talking with Bill Leaders, news editor at Isthmus, and Chris Latta, public relations account executive at Avacom Marketing Communications. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. You can join us by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up after 4 this afternoon, Ben Marins is with you. It's your views on the news every Friday after 4. We are reviewing the top news stories of the week. We have two guests with us, Bill Leaders and Chris Latta. And I wanted to backtrack a little bit, gentlemen, back to the bailout news. The Big Three CEO, Big Three automaker CEOs will be back on Capitol Hill today asking for their $34 billion. Do you think this is going to happen, Bill Leaders? Is the government going to bail out the automakers before it's too late?
Well, maybe they should before it's too late, because last time the automakers came to Washington, they said they needed $25 billion. Now, after a couple of weeks, it's $34 billion. If they don't act soon, it's going to be a higher price tag.
Yeah, Chris Latta?
I mean, I think something has to happen in some form, and I think what you're seeing right now is a little bit of the posturing that politicians like to do, but I think at the end of the day, they're going to realize that something has to happen. I think that after that initial visit to Washington, the leaders of the Big Three automakers were a little more humbled. They expected that they were going to get an easy handout, I think, and you know, the idea that they would fly their jets to D.C. to ask for billions of taxpayer dollars is just ludicrous, and even more so in retrospect, and I think they realize that, or are realizing that a lot of work has to be done. Concessions need to be made, and they basically need to hand over the keys for a while before they're going to see the help that they obviously need.
Let's take a couple of calls on this, and Mike in Iron River is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that it goes deeper than fuel-efficient vehicles. What they need to make is affordable vehicles. You don't need power windows, power door locks, remote starters, leather-heated seats. You know, build things that people can afford that without all these gadgets that break anyways, and you know, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah. Any comment on that, Bill?
I have these heated car seats in my Saturn. It's really wonderful.
On a day like this, it is. So, Chris Latta?
Yeah, I have power windows, and I enjoy those as well. I think there's always going to be a market for those, you know, sort of tricked-out cars, as it were, and I think there's always going to be a market for more, you know, efficient, lower-cost vehicles as well, and I think you know, if a business is worth its salt and knows what it's doing, it knows what the market can bear. Unfortunately, in the case of the Big Three, I guess they are finding out that they didn't know as much as they thought, that if they build it, people wouldn't come. So obviously these companies need to retool what they're doing and look at the market and say, well, what can the market bear?
Absolutely. And what Detroit has been doing is it's been putting all of its innovation into making cars with all these bells and whistles and not in maximizing efficiency. And that's just the wrong way to go. And they do need to rethink on both directions, making cars more fuel efficient, making them more affordable. And they can do it. I mean, this is the United States of America. We can build a car that meets the needs of the future.
Gary in Madison is our next caller. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. As a Democrat, I still think it's a bit of a stretch to blame George Bush for the woes of the auto industry. I think that a lot of it can be laid at the doorstep of the American people. And some of these folks are going to be driving their Japanese cars right to the poorhouse. That's my comment. Thanks.
Yeah, well, what about that, Bill Leaders?
I think it's a point worth making. I think one thing that people need to do as we look to the future and look at the crisis that our nation is in is to remember that, you know, when you buy American, when you make the choice to buy an American automobile as opposed to a foreign automobile, that you're helping keep money here, you're helping keep jobs here, and that is a net plus. That said, I don't think people necessarily have to buy whatever it is that Detroit produces, whether or not it's what they want. And, you know, there is some sense in which the cars that some people want are not coming out of Detroit. And so, you know, it's not their fault that they make that choice to go elsewhere.
Yeah, well, hardly anyone is buying anything. All sorts of economic numbers out this week with retail sales down in November, not what retailers wanted to see. New unemployment numbers are out today. The Labor Department says employers chopped 533,000 jobs last month, pushing the unemployment rate to a 15-year high. 6.7%. The job cuts were the most since 1974. It's proof the recession, already a year old, is getting deeper. And Chris Latta, will the efforts of the federal government keep us out of an even deeper recession?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, you know, you want to hope that we've hit bottom at this point, but then the bad news keeps getting worse, and the fact that we've already been in it for a year, I think that most estimators would expect that we're probably going to be in this at least throughout a good chunk of 2009. I mean, it's very difficult for the federal government to wave a magic wand and fix these problems in a day. I don't think this is going to go away. I think from the business side, the commercial side of things, businesses are looking at ways to readjust and prepare for a new economy where they're going to have to downsize. That's something where the ripple effects, I think, are going to be continued to be felt for quite a while. I do want to return back to one point that was made a minute ago about buying American, and I appreciate the sentiment of the caller who made that, but I don't know how you define buy American in 2008 when so many things are coming in from overseas, when you have car makers like Toyota building plants in the U.S. and these cars, you know, these supposedly foreign cars are being built here in America. It's getting harder and harder to identify what buy American really means in a global economy.
Yeah, there are Toyotas being built right here. That's right. Everybody wants to talk the auto bailout. I'm trying to go to other issues, but let's go to a caller. Carolyn in Green Bay. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. There's something that I don't think I've ever heard anyone mention in this whole deal was, and I don't remember the exact details, but I want to say like 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago, it was during the Bush administration, there were tax credits given when people bought like Hummers and vehicles over a certain poundage. I forget exactly what that was, but it seems like that might have been something that kind of messed up the works and created an artificial incentive for people to buy these big, huge vehicles, which meant that the auto industry kept producing them because of this artificial incentive.
Absolutely. There were tax credits for buying SUVs. I'm not sure if it was for individuals as well as business, certainly for businesses, and that helped fuel the market for those huge vehicles. There were also no incentives or no pressure from government for Detroit to make fuel-efficient vehicles, which is a tragedy.
Right. Yeah, I don't know the details of that, but obviously in hindsight, it doesn't look like a very smart move.
Yeah. All right, thanks very much for the call. Well, let's take one more call on this, and then we are going to try to move on. Kevin in Soldiers Grove, go ahead.
Good morning. I've not heard this issue addressed. I've got a friend whose folks live in Germany. He's from Germany and visited there a couple years ago and was astounded to find out that Ford makes an Escort that they sell in Germany that gets 75 miles to the gallon. We don't have those Escorts here. I'm driving an Escort right now, and I get about 30. Why do we not have cars like that that in our country get good mileage, and why does no one bring this out that Ford is already making these and selling them in other countries?
Did you know that, Bill Leaders?
I didn't know that, but I can think of two reasons for it. One is that gasoline in Germany is about $8 a gallon, so there's a market pressure for fuel-efficient cars. And second, that, you know, the automakers here have just never made fuel efficiency a priority, and they need to do that now.
Mm-hmm. Chris,
sure. And when I drove an Escort, I only got 25, so 75 sounds really good. And I'm just hoping that he's not confusing kilometers with miles on that, because that'd be a different story. but yeah, I mean, if the technology out there exists, and I think we all agree that it does, it just has to be able to be mass marketed at a price that people can afford, then absolutely the big three ought to be building those vehicles. I mean, that's clear that has to be part of the mix. And if they have the technology and are able to do it, figure out a way to mass produce it, then they need to be working on that. That needs to be part of the mix, no doubt about it.
Well, while we're talking about the economy and bailouts, President-elect Barack Obama met with the nation's governors this week talking about how the federal government might be able to help states who are experiencing very deep economic problems. And here's what Governor Doyle had to say about that meeting with Barack Obama.
I believe we have to make sure that we protect our most basic priorities, and for me that's the educational system and it's our basic health care needs in the state. And to the extent that we get federal money, it will help us in doing that, but it is not going to eliminate the need for us to make very deep cuts and some very, very hard choices in the state.
Wisconsin facing a $5.4 billion budget shortfall. So is the federal government going to be able to help out Wisconsin? Chris Lotto first.
Well, I would imagine so. To the degree, you know, to what degree, I don't know. But I think to say again that that's going to be the magic wand or the magic fix that's going to take care of all the problems is extraordinarily naive. You know, Wisconsin typically doesn't get its fair share of federal money back anyway. I mean, let's face it, the problems in Wisconsin in terms of budgeting and shortfalls are not just a result of the current economy. It's the result of both parties in the state who have not done a good enough job of balancing the books, and we're seeing this come home to roost right now. So, sure, the federal government may throw in some money into the pot to help Wisconsin, but that is not going to be enough. I mean, there are going to have to be some very hard decisions made in this state about what we really need to pay for and what we can cut and how we can bring the books into balance. You know, one thing that we are hearing a lot of talk about from the Democrat side now is, you know, which taxes are going to go up? Are we going to raise an income tax surcharge? Are we going to raise the sales tax? I mean, and of course, in this kind of economy, it's the absolute wrong direction to go in. But, you know, we'll have to see how much the federal government is willing to help out Wisconsin and other states. Clearly, most of the states in the country are in trouble right now.
You know, Republicans always say that raising taxes is the wrong direction to go in. And yet, you know, over the years, various sectors of the Wisconsin economy have gotten a really good deal from our state government. Their taxes have gone down. Corporate taxes have gone down. The progressive income tax is much less progressive than it used to be. There are people who can afford to pay more. There are people who should be paying more. In many areas, tax increases make sense. And the state of Wisconsin is going to have to embrace some of those tax increases to get out of the current budget hole. There's no two ways about it. It's going to have to happen, and it should happen.
Yeah. Why shouldn't it happen, Chris Lotto?
Well, I'd be curious to hear what tax increases should be going on. I mean, I know business is the boogeyman that everybody likes to go after, so I suppose that's one. But, I mean, what other tax increases are we talking about? I mean, we're talking about, you know, unemployment rising in this state. We're talking about people struggling to hold on to their jobs, struggling to pay their bills, and then we're going to raise taxes on them. It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, there are areas within the sales tax, for instance, that the sales tax could be extended to certain categories like dog grooming some legal work, private investigators, things like that.
But I think that's just playing around the margins, though.
Well,
I mean,
that's
not going to address a $5.4 billion deficit.
It will help. And there are also tax exemptions. You know, our corporations in Wisconsin are paying less of the total tax share now than they were 20 years ago. If we brought our economy back to where it was 20 years ago in terms of taxation of corporations, we would be better off.
Yeah. So
I think the idea that you can tax your way into to fiscal stability in a time of great instability is just the wrong way to go. And I think the majority of people out there, it's just a common sense thing, I think, would agree.
Well, Chris Lytle, where are you going to cut billions out of the budget?
Well, I'm not going to claim to be a budget expert, but I am going to say that they need to take a look at everything, and they need to be serious about reviewing it and looking for everywhere that, I mean, it's a time to decide what's essential and what's non-essential in state government. What do we need to pay for? What we need to help our most vulnerable in society. We need to make sure that kids are being educated, that we're meeting our responsibilities in education, and a few other basic needs. But beyond that, where can we go? Where do we need to cut? And there are going to have to be some hard cuts. There's no doubt about it. You will not get $5.4 billion cut out of a state budget by not making deep cuts that people are not going to like.
Yeah, but you're
it's
not...
up to both parties, frankly, to have the intestinal fortitude to do that.
I agree, and everyone expects that cuts will happen, but you're not going to get your way to $5.4 billion just with cuts. You have to bring in new revenue.
Sure, I think we're all probably dancing around the issue that probably at some point an income tax or sales tax increase is probably going to be on the table. I mean, that is something that may be unavoidable. On the other hand, there may be an effort in state government to sort of ride this out and say, well, gee, maybe in 9-12 months we'll be bouncing back and more of the revenues will be rolling back in, and maybe we can get by with just patchwork for a while. We'll have to see.
Let's take a caller on this. Pat in Oconomowoc. Good morning.
Yes, just a comment. I hear from, I believe, the first catch made a comment that, Republicans' answer always is to cut and never to raise taxes. Well, it seems fairly interesting to me that what Barack Obama ran on was a platform of cutting taxes. His message was traditionally a Republican message. I think most independent, thinkers, people across the board realize that whenever you cut taxes, whether it's on business or the American folks out there, there's more money out that they can spend on the economy, and tax revenues usually increase. I guess I would like to hear both callers on that point.
Well, both of our guests. Let's start with Bill Leaders.
Yes, Barack Obama did run on a platform of cutting taxes for the vast majority of taxpayers. He's probably going to do that. It probably won't be a huge amount that people will see their taxes go down by, given the economic needs of the country. But he did make that promise, and he can fulfill it. And he can make up the gap simply by going back to the taxation standards on the upper income people that were in place, before George Bush took office. Simply to going back to the old status quo would raise a huge amount of additional revenue and allow the taxes for the majority of the population to be cut.
Mm-hmm. Chris Lytle?
Yeah, the caller's right. One of the platforms that Barack Obama did run on. Of course, the definition of middle class continued to change in the closing days of the campaign, and the threshold for who is going to see a tax increase kept getting lowered. So we'll see what the final package of tax cuts from President-elect Obama looks like. I would just go back to the point that, at this stage of the game, it's really not, we need to be looking in other directions. And let's face it, Wisconsin does raise taxes. They raise taxes on, when I register my car every year, I'm paying more and more to do that. Granted, it's called a fee, but we all know what it really is. Government is asking you for more money, and you're paying for that. So we have been seeing tax increases under Jim Doyle. The question is he going to bite the bullet and say, okay, there's nothing else I can do. We need to look at one of the big ones, income or sales taxes.
Let's take a caller. We have Jason calling from, I'm not sure where, in Minnesota. Go ahead, Jason. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm just calling, hearing the debate versus raising versus lowering taxes. My father and I own a small business. It's a lumberyard hardware store. And granted, you can raise our taxes and get more money out of us, per se, out of our corporation, but yet that means potentially laying two people off, which takes them off the payroll, which also puts them on unemployment, and just continues to draw more funds from the state budget already. And like I said, basically decreasing our taxes allows us to put more inventory and allows us to lower our prices and allows us to then obviously become more busy, hire more people, so on and so forth. So I agree with the fact that I don't see any way that increasing corporations, being them big or small, benefit the current economic conditions whatsoever.
You want to argue otherwise, Bill Leaders?
Well, I just don't think there's much choice in the current picture. Some taxes have to increase. And Barack Obama and his campaign promises and in his economic platform does say that truly small businesses are not going to bear the brunt of tax increases at the federal level. I think it could also be structured in Wisconsin that truly small businesses, you're talking about places that employ a small number of employees, that they don't have to bear the brunt of any tax increase. But there are corporations that operate out of the state of Wisconsin. There are financial industry and insurance industry and hospital and healthcare industries that can afford to pay more, and they're going to have to get the state out of the jam that it's in.
Let's take one more caller. We have Rick in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to look at the other side. There's so much waste in government, especially in Wisconsin with their bidding process. They need to address these bids that they're a fixed amount. There's no cost overruns and things like this, and give them a bonus if they come in under budget.
Oh, all right.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's right. I think that, you know, to address the last two callers, first of all, I can't think of a better real-world example than the previous caller laid out. You raise taxes, companies that are already struggling are going to have to make cuts somewhere as a result to pay for those taxes. Where are they going to do it? One of the places that's going to be on the chopping block is obviously in terms of personnel. And again, when you're seeing unemployment go up and you're seeing businesses already struggling, that's the wrong direction to go in. Getting back to this most recent caller, the idea that let's see first what we can cut. Let's see a list that is realistic, not an alarmist sort of, well, we have to cut, you know, kindergarten programs throughout the state, no more school lunches, you know, that kind of thing. Let's see something that's realistic in terms of what is something that is not an essential. And granted, that's, as I said before, the cliche, the devil's in the details, but we need to see that. We need to see where we can cut, what is non-essential, what is not mandated by government, and where we can start to trim back. Let's start there before we start saying, well, we got to raise taxes, and that's going to fix all the problems, because that's just going to create a new set of problems.
You know, we're going to have former Wisconsin Governor Tony Earle on the air with us on Monday during our state capitol report, the 7 o'clock hour between 7 and 8 o'clock. He had to deal with budget deficits, and if I recall correctly, he did hike taxes. Do you remember Bill Leaders?
I think that he did.
Yeah.
I think he inherited a fiscal mess, and he straightened it out to a large extent.
So we'll see if Governor Earle has some advice for Governor Doyle on Monday. Let's take a short pause and then talk about other issues in the news this week. This is our Friday Week in Review, talking today with Bill Leaders, news editor at Isthmus Newsweekly in Madison, and Chris Lotto, public relations account executive at Avacom Marketing Communications. 1-800-642-1234, toll free from anywhere. You know, we haven't talked about some international issues yet, including those terror attacks in India and the implication of that. So let's talk a little bit about that after this break. You can email us, too, at talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is our Week in Review, talking this week with Bill Leaders and Chris Lotto, and with you if you'd like to join in with an item from the news this week at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We've already talked lots about the economy, lots about the proposed bailout of the auto industry, talked about the budget problems facing the state of Wisconsin as well. Well, we haven't really talked about anything on the international scene, and it was some scary stuff going on the international scene. We had over the Thanksgiving holiday period attacks going on in India, and India is blaming Pakistan, and now we have tensions rising between those two countries. Scary stuff, Bill Leaders?
It's absolutely scary, and I read quite a lot about this.
Hold on, I'm not sure. Okay, go ahead. I didn't think your mic was on. Okay, go ahead.
I've read quite a lot about what's been going on in India, and I'm trying to find out what motivated someone to launch these highly orchestrated, coordinated terror attacks. What was the advantage? And the best that I can come up with is it seems to be somebody who is trying to destabilize the process of the peace process between India and the nation formerly known as Pakistan. Now people are saying Pakistan.
Oh, sorry.
it does seem as though that's the goal. And it seems as though there are people in India who are playing right along into that by blaming Pakistan, officials for somehow being involved in this. And from what I've seen is the government officials in Pakistan have thoroughly and completely and convincingly denounced the attacks and distanced themselves from them. They had nothing to do with it. There may be individuals within that nation that had some role, but it wasn't something that was coming from the government. And yet people within India who want to destabilize the peace process are seizing on this to say, look at what they did. We can't make peace with those folks. And I think it's really a tragic development.
Well, Chris Lotto?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. And what we're seeing, I mean, based on what I've read about this, is that it apparently is the attackers had ties to an Islamic militant group that's based in Pakistan. Or Pakistan. Oh, I'm going to have to get used to that one. But yeah, and obviously, when a nation is attacked like that, like what happened in India, passions run high. Perhaps people aren't, you know, thinking straight. They're acting on anger and passion and sadness, and not looking at the whole picture. And so that is obviously a danger. And presumably, what the terrorists were looking to do was to sort of destabilize relations. I mean, I think that's what one of their goals in any terrorist attack is to cause havoc. And clearly, that's what this has done. And, you know, you hope that cooler heads are ultimately going to prevail, because it's already obviously a very unstable region. And more attacks like this are going to, you know, bring things closer to the edge of really exploding over there. But, you know, it's an understandable sort of human nature thing to take a look at it and not look at the nuances and the details of what really went down.
I saw something really interesting in the New York Times about this, where the Pakistani foreign minister, whose name I won't even try to pronounce, appeared on Indian television and was visibly moved by the attacks, which he called barbaric. I think that's where official Pakistan is on this, is they are appalled by what has happened. They had nothing to do with it.
Of course, what needs to happen now, I think, though, is Pakistan needs to live up to, you know, the emotion that it's showing and do everything in its power to help root those groups out. And I think that will go a long way toward helping them show that they are indeed sincere when they say that they were not responsible for it and want to help out and want to bring those responsible to justice. I think that needs to happen immediately as well.
Let's hear what John in Richland County has to say. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. My comment is...
Well, we don't know what your comment is because we lost you. Let's talk a little bit about Barack Obama making it official on Monday, I believe, that his foreign policy national security team will be Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and Bill Gates staying on as Defense Secretary and retired Marine General James Jones, National Security Advisor. I'm wondering just general reactions, Bill Leaders, if you think Barack Obama has picked a good team to be overseeing these threats to us.
Well, he's picked a team that's heavy on experience, but he's also picked a team that consists largely of people who disagree with him fundamentally on some of his main foreign policy agenda items. Many of the people who now constitute Barack Obama's intelligence and foreign policy team are people who were supportive of the war in Iraq. And I think it's troubling to this extent that Barack Obama has always said his commitment is to extricate the United States from that involvement, but that he would listen very closely to the advice that he received. Then he surrounds himself with advisors who were essentially supportive of that involvement. So I'd be concerned that he will be getting advice that will take him away from the commitment that he made to voters that he will get us out of there.
What do you think of the team, Chris Lowry?
Well, I'm actually going to offer a little praise to Barack Obama, and I'm not sure why I'm doing this, but I think he recognizes that he needs folks with experience who know what's going on over there, and perhaps they will provide him with the best information and the best opportunity to figure out a way out of it. So I actually think, tactically speaking, it's a fairly smart move. I mean, the highest profile decision this week was obviously the Hillary Clinton Secretary of State thing, and that's, I think, pretty clearly a case of, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, isn't it? I mean, I'm not sure that she's the best pick for Secretary of State. I would have thought maybe health or education as maybe places that were more logical fits for somebody like Hillary Clinton. After all, they both criticized each other's foreign policy credentials before, so I'm not sure how she suddenly became an expert in the last 9 months. But I think that there's some political calculation here that Barack Obama recognizes the need to get Hillary Clinton involved in his administration, which neutralizes her not only as a voice of dissension in the Senate, but further down the road, if Barack Obama is still struggling in a couple of years to maybe keep Hillary Clinton from saying, you know what, I'm going to run for president in 2012. That kind of neutralizes that threat.
You used a great word, calculation. I think there's a great deal of calculation in Barack Obama picking Hillary Clinton and picking Robert Gates and picking Jim Jones for National Security Advisor. And it's a little troubling to me that that these picks are so acceptable to people like Chris Lotto. I'd be happier with Barack Obama's cabinet if Chris Lotto was a little bit more unhappy with
it. Well, there you go.
there was a runoff election in Georgia this week, and the Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss did win that runoff over his Democratic challenger. Al Franken and Norm Coleman in Minnesota are still in the middle of a recount, but it doesn't look like Bill Leaders, the Democrats will get that magic 60. Is that a big deal or not?
Well, it does mean that they can't beat the filibuster, but I don't know how many issues that's going to come into play. We need to move forward as a nation. I think even some Republicans are willing to concede that point on major issues. I think all this election this week proved is that you can still win election in the state of Georgia as a Republican. It doesn't mean that the Republican Party is somehow in resurgence. Maybe the name Saxby, though, will come in, back into fashion.
Yeah, where did that come from? Chris Lotto?
Yeah, and apparently Georgia is one of the few places where a Republican can still win election. But, it does help in the sense that it does not give, I mean, Democrats now have the keys to the kingdom. They run the federal government. They have the presidency in Wisconsin. We have a Democrat governor and a Democrat legislature. I mean, it is their turn to lead. It is clear that the voters have said it is time to give the other party a chance and move them in pretty sweeping numbers. We don't have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. Thank goodness for that. But it's close enough, and Democrats have a clear majority from which they can now lead, and they can now point us in the direction that they think is best. And we'll see if at the end of the day it is the best thing. I have been fascinated by what's going on in Minnesota. It seems as though Norm Coleman is holding on to a lead of, I think I saw this morning, of about 300 votes. The Franken campaign keeps, stamping its feet, saying, well, what about these votes? What about these that turned up here? What about these missing in an envelope? But it looks like Norm Coleman's been holding on to his lead, so he'll, by the slimmest of margins, be able to win that seat, assuming there's not a court challenge, which I can't imagine there wouldn't be when a margin's that tight.
Sarah Palin was, Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, drew some big crowds when she was in Georgia campaigning for Saxby Chambliss, and some national commentators are still noting what a big base she has and how popular she is among that base. Is she a player for 2012, Chris Lotto?
We talked about this before when I've been on the show, and I'm still not convinced that she is the right selection for 2012. I mean, she certainly is obviously welcome to jump in the race and run. She clearly has her supporters. I think, we're still seeing stories in the media popping up where they're still after her for what's going on in Alaska with reporting trips late and things like that. So they're not going to let her go. If she does decide to run, she's going to face a rough road, because if you thought 2008 was bad, if she's going to run in 2012, they're going to have plenty more time to dig into every single little scrap of whatever she was even vaguely associated with during her time in Alaska and during her time as mayor and her family and everything else. She just faces a rough road. She really was a spark, a touch point in this campaign where people either loved her or hated her. And I think that those who hate her are really going to be chomping at the bit for an opportunity to take her apart in 2012. I mean, it would be an uphill battle for her. But there's no doubt that she also inspires a lot of people in the Republican base. Whether running for president is the best way to use that power and that ability, I'm not sure. I would almost prefer to see her maybe spend a little more time in Alaska, maybe run for U.S. Senate if that opportunity were to present itself, something like that, where I think she could maybe get her feet wet a little bit more on the national and international stage before she decides to jump right back in to run for president.
Bill, did you love her or hate her?
I hate her, but I agree with just about everything that Chris Lotto just said, that Sarah Palin does have enormous appeal to a certain group of people, but by and large, I think she's also got a lot of negatives, and probably the majority of Americans dislike and distrust her.
You know, we have a caller who wants to talk about a local issue, a Madison issue, but one that is getting some national attention, actually. Stephen Madison is with us. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Thank you, Joy. Good morning. I'm concerned about this 8 months of deception the police and district attorney perpetrated with keeping a search warrant sealed. They said it was critical to investigation. When it becomes unsealed, they say it was really not that big a deal, but it does reveal a duplicitous withholding of facts and misstatement of other facts. This has to do with a murder in Madison that Bill is very familiar with.
Yeah, we're talking about the student, Brittany Zimmerman,
who was a 21-year-old student who was killed in early April in Madison. And the caller is exactly, I wrote about this in Isthmus this week. You can see it on the dailypage.com. And I made the exact same point that the caller is making, that there was a orchestrated campaign of deception that was waged by the police department, by the district attorney's office, and by the 911 center here in Dane County with regard to this communication.
Bill, I'm not sure everybody listening is totally familiar with
it. Oh, sure.
But, go ahead.
The student was killed on April 2nd. Brittany Zimmerman was murdered in her apartment in Madison, just a couple blocks from the Madison police station. And it emerged, my paper actually was the first to report, that she had made a cell phone call to 911 before she was killed. And what has happened since then is that the authorities have insisted that the content of that call could not be disclosed because it would jeopardize the integrity of their investigation. Then they forgot to seek an extension of secrecy provisions for some search warrants that had been filed in the case, and those accidentally became public this week. When those search warrants became public, it was stated in them that on the call that was made by Brittany Zimmerman, for which no officers were dispatched, there were sounds of screaming and sounds of a struggle that could be heard. And, you know, that has reopened these wounds. And my feeling all along was that the only reason that the authorities ever tried to cover up the content of this call was to protect themselves and spare themselves the embarrassment of not having properly responded to this emergency.
Yeah.
And I think that's been affirmed by what has come out this week.
And now there are other media outlets that want more records released, and there is some balking at doing that?
Yes, there is a lawsuit that's been filed over, the audio 911 tape, that's coming up for hearing next week. There's no reason anymore not to release this. People know now that it contains screaming and sounds of a struggle, and it has to, the cops have to give it up.
Yeah, we're pretty much out of time, and I'm assuming, Chris Lotto, that you don't have a reaction to this.
Well,
case.
I did want to applaud Bill. I know that the Isthmus has been hard at work on that story and has been doing a great job. I think I saw an Isthmus reporter on Fox News of all places this week talking about the case. But I have heard a little bit of rumbling about the concern that the bad apples who work at the 911 call center, that it's difficult, if not impossible, to get rid of them. And I'm wondering if you hear the same thing or what you know about that, Bill.
I will have to save that for another time because we are absolutely out of time. Bill Leaders, Chris Lotto, thank you both for being with us. Chris Lotto is a public relations account executive at Avacom Marketing and Bill Leaders news editor at Isthmus. I'm Joy Cardine. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Sarah Carroll for producing this hour. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.